Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right, guys, welcome back. I hope everybody has had a wonderful week, and we are back here on LLP for another episode, and we are going to dive into body armor. And we're going to talk kind of in general terms about the development of body armor all the way from ancient times till now. We're not going to get completely in the weeds on every little tiny historical context and every little tiny developmental node, if you will. But we are going to generally give you an idea of how body armor has shaped not only the face of warfare, but the face of personal protection, right? There's civilians here in the U.S. and abroad have access to body armor to protect themselves. Obviously, it's been used now by various military and law enforcement all over the country in terms of now, so to speak. Before we get rolling here today, I'd like to give a shout out to the show's sponsor, Koi CBD. They have some amazing CBD products, oils, balms, gummies, flower, all kind of awesome stuff. I love their Delta 8 products. I have terrible back pain, and it really helps with my back pain. They also do some amazing dog treats. So if you've got some dogs that are crazy like mine, or maybe you've got an elderly dog that's got some bad back pain or something, that will definitely help them sleep and get around a lot better. These guys are super veteran and police friendly, really awesome dudes. Really good group of people. If you'd like to support them, use the code LLP. That's Lima Papa for you military folks, and you'll receive 15% off. So check them out, Koi CBD. So armor is definitely not going anywhere, and it's a great passive way to protect yourself. I mean, you don't even have to own a gun to own body armor and be able to, you know, defend yourself. But armor's come a long way, and not all of it's made equally. And we're going to try to draw on some original videos that we've made over on Iraq Veteran 8888 before. And hopefully that'll give you all an idea. I mean, we're going to refer probably to some of the older tests and things. You know, we've dealt with a lot of different types of armor from a varying amount of different companies. Don't think that we're trying to point to any one company more than the other. I don't want it to seem that way. We want people to definitely check out all the content and the individual tests that we've done on each product and draw a conclusion based on what you feel you saw in the video, and draw your own conclusions and do your own research. So we're certainly not advocating for any one brand over the other. We're just going to try to openly and honestly kind of go through some of these technologies using various videos that we have filmed over the years as examples to give you an idea here. So, there's a lot of different armor out there.
Absolutely. So with that said, you hit the nail on the head. There, it is the most passive way that you can protect yourself, because one, it doesn't even require you to physically fight back. It's really more of a defensive posture item, and it is a shame that there are certain states that are trying to ban or outlaw the sale of body armor. Mainly, I think the most recent one to come to mind is New York. They're trying to institute a type of body armor ban. Connecticut is not illegal to own it there, but it is illegal to ship it there, which is really weird. Unless you're active military or law enforcement, and you have to show credentials, you can ship it to Connecticut, but you can't actually ship it to a civilian there, which is really weird. As far as materials go, I mean, it's been around since the dawn of time. I mean, medieval knights were using armor. Even before that, they had just really rudimentary leather with metal studs, kind of like body armor when the weapons were a little bit more crude. But there came a point in time that it hit a, value of diminishing returns. So you could put, and that, I think that happened right around when the, like, firearm was initially invented. They didn't matter how much armor, the metallurgy just wasn't there to protect them from the gunpowder and the actual bullet going through. But up until that point, they were able to stop arrows and bolts from crossbows and stuff like that. So it's really interesting to see that, how that happened. And for a long time, there was like a lull in body armor technology because nobody could really figure out how to stop a bullet. It was just one of those things. So as soon as it was invented, it pretty much went unscathed without body armor up until old buddy got robbed as a pizza delivery guy and decided that he was going to create a bulletproof vest.
Oh.
And thus modern day technology was born.
Absolutely. So, you know, there has been a lot of development with body armor. And when you look at medieval knights and, you know, you see all this lavish armor that's finely fitted and everything. And, you know, back then you didn't just simply don a set of armor and bam, you're a knight. No, the armor was individually fitted for each soldier, each knight, I should say. You know, and in those situations, you know, armor back then, a suit of armor finely fitted and finely, you know, engraved with all this random filigree and your coat of arms and all, it was definitely a symbol of status, right? You know, obviously a more wealthy family would, you know, have a much nicer set of armor fitted for their noblemen or something like that, that went off to, you know, become a knight, because they also understood that back then knighthood also meant a big chance in politics too. You know, you could serve as a knight, and then once you got out of your, you know, knighting, whatever you do,
knighthood.
I guess you got out of your knighthood or got out of your day job as a knight, I guess then you could dive into the political realm and have a little bit more, you know, status and things. So armor at one point was such an expensive item that, of course, your average, you know, person could certainly not afford it, you know, some peasant or whatever. But even your average soldiers on the battlefield that would just be like your average pikeman or whoever, they couldn't afford it either. So armor went from being one of those things that, you know, first it was just, you know, general troops on the battlefield just trying to, you know, find ways to protect themselves. I mean, you look at our Native American Indians and their, you know, elaborate wooden, you know, chess pieces with all the vibrant colors and everything to strike fear into the enemy and to demoralize the enemy. So some early, you know, forms of armor might not have served such a role in physically protecting you as much as it did separate you apart from the other warriors. You know, maybe if you were a more advanced warrior, or, you know, warrior that had been in the, you know, tribe a little longer and had seen a lot more battles, you might have a certain amount of feathers or colors. So it was also, again, even like you look at the American Indians, you look at knights, it doesn't matter. Armor has always, you know, served a cultural purpose more so than just physical protection. It's also the protection of your principles, your honor. It represents the things that make up a fighting person. So, you know, armor went from being decorative and cultural to being, you know, physically needing to protect you. And you look at, you know, ancient knights and all of these things. So, of course, I say ancient, but, you know, medieval knights and things with their fitted armor and all. Very ornate and very fitted and very expensive. But as, you know, weapons technology progressed, as Matt said, of course, the need for a more mass-produced type of armor to come out was certainly a need, right? So as these weapons are more deadly, soldiers on the battlefield need to be able to protect themselves. You look at the early days of when pikemen started giving way to, like, musketeers and, you know, black powder and musket balls and, you know, the invention of gunpowder. Then troops would, you know, have like a cuirass to protect themselves from spear blows, but then could also maybe take a glancing round ball from a musket or something. And that went on for a really long time. And of course, as technology and firearms progressed even more, you end up, you know, that gave way to rifled muskets, but they were still black powder, not necessarily enough velocity to defeat some armor. You know, there were situations like down in Australia, Ned Kelly and that big shootout in Australia. A lot of the guns they were using at the time were just, you know, smokeless powder or black powder and everything. So Ned Kelly was able to take like an old boiler and make a suit of armor out of a, like an old boiler. It's just iron or whatever. And the bullets are just bouncing off, because the issue is even the most basic of pot metals could be used as armor back then because of the velocities of the projectiles and the types of powder you're using are just not capable of piercing, you know, those items. So as smokeless powder came around, then you saw, okay, situations where, all right, you know, this 30-06 or this 8mm, this thing's going to, you know, glance right through a simple pot metal, you know, that we're not talking Ned Kelly's pot metal armor anymore. You're talking a high velocity smokeless round with a lot of energy. And then that's when things start to get complicated. You get into more modern armor where soldiers are put in very deadly situations, and you need armor that can stop very high velocity threats out of increasingly higher threats and greater amounts of firearms technology. So you've got to be able to keep up with the technology of the firearms technology. So the armor and gun technology grew together. As the deadliness of the guns got worse and worse, so did the need for better protection.
And it got to the point where the body armor industry couldn't keep up. So you were exceeding those, like the velocity of the rounds were coming out so fast that it was able to defeat basically any armor that was practical at the time, which is why you see that there was no body armor, even on like the MACV side, they weren't using body armor in Vietnam. And those were, I would call those more modern times. I mean, you had a lot of modern technology. We had been to the moon at that point, but yet we still didn't have a way to stop these little pieces of lead from piercing your body. And then they came out with soft armor, and soft armor led the way to like hard armor, which was originally were like steel plates. The metallurgy got a lot better. We were able to refine a lot of the impurities out of the metal. And then they started putting, penetrators into them to defeat that body armor. And then there was other ways to get around the penetrator. They just make more, like more pure steel or thicker steel. So it was just like this cat and mouse game of like, hey, I'm going to keep producing this body armor. We're going to, you know, still create ways to defeat the body armor. And now we're left with this technology with armor that as of right now, unless you're shooting like a like an anti-material round, body armor is able to defeat, I would say, pretty much every round that's not like an anti-material round.
You know, and it's crazy when you look at all of the accounts of like, okay, think about the Civil War and on when it comes to just small arms development, right? You didn't see people running around in body armor. Mm-hmm. Look at all the old paintings, right? Look, those soldiers weren't wearing body armor. They were running around with black powder, you know, muzzle loaders and things like that, or you know, maybe even crude breech loaders as it got, you know, closer to that transitional period. But these soldiers just running around in cotton or wool uniforms. And I guess they figure, well, there's no armor that can really, that we can mass produce and issue to everybody. And you're so hot in this freaking wool.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to strap a, you know, I don't know, a kettle to you and try to, you know, block the round. So for a long time, I mean, look at soldiers from World War One, World War Two. Those guys are just out there doing their thing. No body armor. I mean, now, of course, there is like some flak jackets and some like heavy wool coats. I mean, I know some people have heard these stories from like the Korean War where, you know, they were claiming that a GI's M2 carbine, which is a full auto M1 carbine, would not penetrate a Korean soldier's coat at 200 yards. That the coats were so thick that the thick wool was stopping the M1 carbine bullets when they were fired at distances that were considerably long distances.
You know, I've never seen a winter coat for the North Korean army or the Chinese. However, I've heard tales of how cold it was in that Chosin Reservoir. And there might be a point where they were so cold and they layered up so much that it might have had a hard time penetrating that. Because, I mean, mm-hmm. if there's one thing that, you know, both Chinese, Russian, and North Koreans know, it's cold weather, how to survive in cold weather.
So when you look at, you know, that war and getting into Vietnam, that kind of made me think about it. You know, in Vietnam, that's when you started seeing soldiers start wearing like flak jackets and things. Mm-hmm. And that was like, in my opinion, maybe I'm wrong or maybe my perspective is not the correct perspective, but that's really when you first started to see body armor issued over a wider variety of troops and widely issued to everybody. And body armor thought of as a, hey, you know, you're on the battlefield, pal, you need this, right? They were dealing with a lot of RPGs and hand grenades, booby traps, and all different kinds of things. So a flak jacket was a good way for them to increase the survivability of a simple explosion or a grenade or something, or a booby trap, even some punji spike come flying towards you. You know, a flak jacket could possibly save your life. So that they really saw the value in, hey, we can make this, you know, kind of semi-armor, like it may not stop a rifle round, but it might be able to stop, you know, something like a, you know, some shrapnel or whatever, or maybe a shotgun. So, it put them into the mindset of, okay, yeah, maybe our troops from now on need to have some form of armor to increase their survivability.
I can see that. I can see it being like a 40% solution. I think that a lot of people underestimate how much shrapnel flies around on the battlefield, especially in like a battle like, you know, any of the Vietnam conflicts. I mean, just I could imagine tons of RPGs, tons of mortars, tons of just hand grenades, white phosphor, like just a metric ton of shrapnel flying around all the time. So flak jacket has probably helped out a great deal. I've had the opportunity to wear one just to try it on. They're extremely heavy, but they're still very malleable. They're very form-fitting. You can move in them. They're outside of the weight, they're not that bad. If you were like a heavy, like a M60 gunner, and you were already carrying a lot of weight, your speed is not your main objective there. I could see that being something like just like those really big dudes would be wearing, just to help stay in the fight a little bit longer.
You know, it's interesting when you think about these flak jackets and armor and everything. And I know by the time, like, let's just getting towards like Desert Storm, that era, you know, I don't know if they were still issuing soft armor that was just really, you know, well upgraded at that point, or if they had some basic hard armor. I don't really know the answer. I guess I could look it up real quick and try to see, but that's when you really saw some better armor coming out by then, for sure.
The first like iteration of military armor were just steel plates. It was like literally flat, like six inch steel plates that they were using in the front and the back, and they were very minimal. They were just covered your heart and your, like, you know, main arteries in your upper chest cavity. And that was it. And you had one in your back. And that's what a lot of the special operations guys were using in the army at the time. And then after that, and that was just steel, like AR-500 at the time. And then you went from that to like your ceramic plates. So you have like straight ceramic plates.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. You guys have seen my meltdown videos before. If you haven't, check them out. That green flak jacket that I wear in the meltdown videos, that's exactly the type of flak jacket that the guys in the Gulf War were using on the first time around. So I just pulled up a picture here, and it showcases like the Gulf War ground assault. And this is actually on the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs website. I just happened to find this. And they are using that exact spec of flak jacket. They have their issue pistols in a green, nylon holster, and they've got those big gas mask bags, which are really probably the same ones we were issued.
Yeah, the mock gear bags.
Yeah, the old one, and ours were old, so they might have been left over from the first time around. But yeah, I don't think these are hard plates in these.
No, not at all. They're all like made for shrapnel only. Like a bullet will sail right through that bad boy because the velocity will just tear through it. But it was made for just big, slow chunks of shrapnel to stop it. But if you look at, you know, the advancements that we have, I mean, for those of you guys that are listening, come check out the video as well, because we do have some metal plates or some armor plates up here. But the first plate is just your e-sappy ceramic plate, and it's probably about half an inch thick. It's really, really thin, single curve, ceramic, basic. I remember that's basically what we had when we were in Iraq.
Very crude.
Yeah. I mean, it not rated for, you know, armor piercing at all. It's just a 7.62 by 54 or 39.
51. Yeah, 7.62 by 51 NATO ball protection.
Yep.
So an M1 Garand black tip would certainly sail right through this.
Yep.
Heavy. Very, very heavy.
Yep.
And not very form-fitting. That's real heavy.
It is heavy, but I'll tell you what I appreciated about it was that it was thin. And with those carries, you're already carrying so much gear. And I mean, you have your standard combat load, 300 plus rounds, hand grenades, 40 millimeter grenades, all of your other kit, your first aid kit, your IFAG. This was back in like 04, 05. None of the cool guy gear was out yet. It was like everything was taped on or hanging on with like 550 cord. None of that existed. So everything, we were very top heavy. Everything is on the top.
Yeah.
So to have a really thin plate like this was really, really helpful. And then, you fast forward and you go to your more modern plates, which are a ceramic composite. So it'll be a mix of ceramic on like the first 3/4 of the plate, and then the backing of the plate will be like a polyethylene to catch that round once it's slowed down. So it'll hit the plate, it'll crack the ceramic, it'll bleed off that excess energy, and then that polyethylene backing will capture the round before it goes through. Which is really one of the good things about having ceramic and a PE hybrid plate, because it's not, if it's all ceramic and it has too much energy, too much kinetic energy is going to hit it, it's going to sail through. If it's all PE or polyethylene, if that round is screaming through, it's going to continue to scream through because the PE will only slow it down, but the hybrid plates will hit it, bleed off the energy, and then it catches that slow round and it prevents it from going into your chest cavity.
Yeah.
And then bleeding out and dying.
That's not what you want.
Yeah.
Sure. In the situation of ceramics, one thing, especially on that era when you're kind of mm-hmm. getting right out of the old sappy plates and just into, you know, a more modern set of armor, it's also very sensitive. You're not supposed to drop your armor,
that's
set
true.
It down real hard. You can crack it. You can compromise the structural integrity of the armor. I believe even the newer armor that's out now, they all do suffer from the minor gremlin of you can't be too rough with them. You got to be careful. I mean, yes, you're in combat. You're bumping around. You're going through all kind of crazy things, but the idea being that you're supposed to avoid, you know, slamming around your armor and cracking it and compromising the structural integrity. Also, the plates do have a finite, across the board, generally, they do have a finite shelf life. You know, you're supposed to use them within a certain amount of time, and then you're supposed to replace them once they get out of their expiration. That's when the fabrics, the coatings, even some of the chemical compositions, I would imagine, I can't speak from experience on that, but every aspect of the plate at that point is considered to be maybe not optimal quality, not to say that it wouldn't stop a projectile or that, you know, it won't still work. I mean, I've got this old sappy plate and it's probably been, you know, out of commission for at least 10, maybe 15 years. Mm-hmm. But is that to say this wouldn't work? Of course it will. Does it work as good as the day it was made? Likely not. All right. At this point, is this thing compromised by now? Maybe. All right. So you start to kind of have a little bit more speculation that comes into it. So that's the only couple of disadvantages I can see, is that the shelf life, as well as the overall composition of the plate being sensitive to damage. Another thing that has improved a lot once you get beyond like regular old sappy plates, and then once you get beyond the polyethylene and composite plates that use more ceramic, you do get to cut down some weight, which is really nice, but also yep. the coatings have improved a lot. Right. So companies, and I'm giving very general examples here, but like some of the testing we've done on AR-500, on Spartan armor, and things like that, where you've got just an AR-550 or AR-500 armor plate that has like an anti-spall coating.
Mm-hmm.
So you can shoot it, and the spalling actually absorbs into this crazy, gnarly, like industrial grade rubber that they put on the outside of the plate. And that's a type of technology that, even back in like the OIF days, I mean, like when you look at, you know, the era that we were over there, 05, 06,
yep.
we wouldn't have had anything that quality of spalling mitigation like the modern armor.
Yeah,
has.
I mean, that's basically it. So it's going to hit the plate and it's going to get absorbed. If the spalling hits the vest, then, you know, hopefully the vest absorbs it. The great news is that there's been tremendous advances in like materials. So like ripstop materials, nylon materials, sewing techniques have improved. But I just wanted to hit real quick on that's, and I'm glad you mentioned that the NIJ certification is extremely important with body armor. I'm trying to be as impartial as possible across the board with body armor. However, there's one thing that I'm very, very adamant about, and that is that if you're going to buy armor to protect yourself, you want to make sure that it works. You want it to be NIJ certified, not tested. And it's okay if a company says, hey, we test our armor to NIJ standards, it's NIJ tested. Okay, great, you tested it that batch. But the only thing that makes me feel good personally about NIJ certification is that, one, you're paying to have it certified, the sample that you send in, but they also do compliance testing. So it's follow-up testing, which means they'll come back and they'll grab a plate out of a batch a year from now or 2 years from now, and they test it, and it has to perform this to the same standard as the sample, and that's compliance. They want to make sure that you as a company that's producing these plates didn't try to cheat the system and are using inadequate materials, you know, cheaper materials to save money. You changed your technique without submitting it for testing and selling it under a tested certified SKU. So to me, when I see a company that advertises that they're NIJ certified, I know that there's almost like a guarantee. If it fails, hopefully that nobody dies, but you can go back and say, hey man, this was a certified plate that got hit with a 54R. It should have stopped it, but it didn't. It punctured my left aorta and I magically lived. So there's accountability there. It holds the company accountable, the manufacturer accountable. But it also gives you the warm and fuzzies. You're like, hey, I have a certified plate. I'm not worried about the quality degradation over time. So that's why you see a lot of certified plates that are guaranteed or warranted for a much longer period. So oftentimes it'll be between 5 and 10 years, which is what you see. And the drop testing, you mentioned drop testing. Part of that NIJ certification is a 4-foot drop. So they drop it from 4 feet on the strike face, and then it still has to perform to that standard. So if they're level 4 plates, they drop it from 4 feet, often multiple times, make sure it doesn't get fractured, hit it with the testing, and it has to pass. So that's all part of that testing.
Well, that's good to know that they have certainly increased the, you know, the ruggedness of the plate, and that can handle a little bit more impacts and kinetic effects on it and everything like that. I will take what you said one step further, maybe a little bit, in that now another thing that we've seen is that the NIJ testing standards haven't been updated in quite a long time, mm-hmm. not only to make account of newer threats that might be out that weren't a part of the original NIJ testing, but to make note of newer armor designs. Like, there are companies that are putting out armor designs that are very next level stuff, and that they actually claim can go through a series of threats that the NIJ doesn't even recognize as being a substantial reason to include that in the standards yet, or that they aren't part of the standards yet. And that's when you get into the extreme multi-hit rate. I don't want to say that that is an actual rating, but I'm just saying, like, the marketing hoopla behind it, right?
Right.
That, oh, this ammo can, or this plate here can take 30 rounds of armor piercing ammo from a machine gun and not go through. Well, that's not an NIJ testing certification. That's more of a marketing chest pump where you're going, hey, look mm-hmm. what my armor can do. And that's cool. I encourage armor companies to go, hey, look what I can do, right? Like Stewie from Mad TV. Look what I can do. Well, anyway, but I think it's cool for companies to go, well, this isn't the standard. This exceeds the standard by like a factor form of 5, you know, like, so that's cool. But I think as you see NIJ certifications start to, maybe they'll come up with some more, you know, different type of certification with more substantial threats or requiring more shots. And yeah, you might see that happen. But then also you're also going to see, you're going to end up seeing the armor companies also go, all right, well, you did that, and that's the standard now. Well, guess what? We're going to go one step further, and we're going to force you to increase it again. And that forces the rest of the market to be really competitive, because then if they have to redo the certifications and there's this different generation of armor that's out there, mm-hmm. well, then now the guys that are making, you know, basic sappy plates or just a coated piece of AR-500 steel, those guys are going to get left in the dust because their armor technology is going to be 2 or 3 generations behind. And then before you know it, it's obsolete because of the new stuff that's out.
That's right. I mean, just think about this for a second. You have a piece of armor that, and this is just to piggyback on what you said about, you know, not like they're trying to do the hoopla around the NIJ testing. Instead of shooting that piece of armor 30 times with a belt fit, I think I am far more likely to be satisfied with seeing it stop for 30-06 black tip rounds over 30 belt fed rounds, because the chances of me in a real life scenario, I will probably get hit with a black tip 30-06 over a belt fed machine gun. So I want to know that I have the highest threat level protection for a singular round than I do having a multi-hit rated piece of armor.
That's a really good point. I didn't consider mm-hmm. that. I mean, you know, the multi-hit rating from like a, you know, machine gun blast or something, that's impressive for marketing purposes. But I would say you're right that I think in a real world situation, it's not like an average person's going to go, yeah, you can't kill me because I'm sitting here soaking up every round you're shooting right. me with, and I'm just going to stand
there
here.
Like Superman.
Yeah, I'm going to stand here and get shot at. So that's not reality. I think more people care about, hey, how close to the edge can this thing get hit yes. and still hold up? Or, yeah. you know, hey, what's the most powerful round it can stop? Because, yeah, I might get hit once by a rifle round. And, hey, what if it's a really big, scary rifle round? You know, can this thing protect me? Can it save me? What about the new ammunition? What about the new bullet designs? So mm-hmm. then you start to think, okay, well, we know what it'll stop of an average threat, but once, what do you get to like, what, 408 Chi-Tag
or something? Dude, crazy, you read my
or
mind.
Slap round or something. You see these viral internet yeah. videos of slap rounds shooting through multiple plates of ammunition, even, or armor, I'm sorry. I can't talk today. It's been a long day.
It's been a long day.
I cannot word today. but when you look at these slap rounds penetrating like multiple pieces of armor, you think, man, like if multiple pieces of armor can't stop it, I want the armor that can stop that.
Yep.
And people kind of think, all right, well, I'm going to think bigger, you know, mm-hmm. have a bigger vision for, you know, what armor can do on an individual.
I'd be very curious to see how these hold up to a 408. You know what? Maybe we'll do a level 4 plate test with a 408 Chi-Tac, and we'll see how that goes. That would be very entertaining and be interesting to see.
408 is a monster round. It is a very capable rifle round and probably one of the flattest shooting,
yep.
most awesome long-range cartridges on this planet today.
So we were talking about level 4. Level 4 is the highest threat level that is in existence right now. So it stops everything up to 30-06 black tip. Which is an armor-piercing round, as well as a 54R armor-piercing round as well. Those are the two threat levels. That's the only differentiating factor between a 3+ and a level 4, are those two rounds. So a level 3+, you know, in my opinion, if you are not going to be in an area that, you know, that's a very common round, a 30-06 black tip or a 54R armor-piercing, if you know that is not going to be in any type of threat that you're going to encounter, a level 3+ plate would probably be a better choice, just because it's about half as light. You're able to get a much more comfortable and lighter plate and loadout. It does cost a little bit more money because they are lighter. They are a hybrid plate, so it's a thin layer of ceramic with polyethylene. But, you know, personally, I've seen tests where they are NIJ tested to 3+, but they will stop level 4 threats. So that's something you have to look out for. And that way you might get the best of both worlds. So if you have this particular plate right here, I mean, this plate is super light. This is a multi-curve plate, which is something we'll get into. You have single curve plates that are just a single curve that go across the chest. And they're not too uncomfortable as long as you're not wearing them for extended periods of time. So, I mean, if you're in most real world scenarios, you're going to have your vest on in an emergency or, you know, something happens and you have it on and then you're taking it off. You're not going to be wearing it, you know, 8 hours a day, you know, 6 days a week. If you are, I would probably recommend going with a multi-curve plate. It's basically curved on the left and the right across your chest, but also the centerpiece that goes up towards your clavicle and protects your, you know, your clavicle area, your trachea, your upper chest. And it's just much more comfortable. It just kind of fits right there and curves in.
So very light and form-fitting.
Very light. I mean, this is, I mean,
well, that's night and day from the plate.
That's like
a third.
Yeah, that comes in at like 3 pounds. Wow. So versus, you know, that Sappy, that's a level 3 plate. That's probably like 6.5 pounds. That level 4 plate is a ceramic NPE plate. That's like right at 8 pounds. That 3+ plate is like 3.5 pounds.
Yeah, so it gives you some specs to kind of think about, yep. you know, and we've tested quite a few of these and they all perform exceptionally well. So and I don't want to think we're trying to like choose, you know, favorites over anybody. Yep. I would like to mention quickly, I haven't tested these yet, but I am going to test them. Battle Steel Battle Blankets. Mm-hmm. They're basically like a throwable piece of armor. So with this concept, and I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but I just wanted to quickly mention it because I talked to Botac the other day, and they were like, yeah, we might send you out one of these things to play with, mm-hmm. and you guys can shoot it or whatever and test it out. But there's all these situations where like a throwable piece of armor is very useful. Maybe SWAT teams or, you know, entry teams use them for various things. Maybe they want to have a little bit of extra cover on a certain mm-hmm. corner and they can, you know, attach it somehow. Or if you're in a home defense situation, and let's say at night, like, you know, when you, you know, go to bed at night, you could actually put one of these battle blankets, you know, near the crib. And that way, if there's any shrapnel or, you know, rounds get sent through your house or something, your baby's protected. So that's probably an outlandish, you know, claim. I'm not saying that the world's that crazy, but
you're just painting a picture.
I'm painting a picture of the uses that you could use the armor for. You could put on the back of your closet door. So like, I don't know, your wife gets scared or you get scared or whoever, your kids, and you hear a knock at, you know, someone beats the door in, you tell them, hey, go to the closet. You know, you got your plan, right? You know,
panic room.
Yeah, panic room. And to know that they can just be in an unassuming closet. And if some happen, you know, gunfire happens to erupt, knowing that you're safe. Mm-hmm. So there's technologies like that. I think that's sort of the apex of the concept, just throwable and stowable armor and, you know, being able to cover a wide area like a wall or something with just a simple roll-up piece of armor. Kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of uses for that. I mean, let's say you keep it in your car and you're rolling through Atlanta and there's a protest going on and you have your, well, painting the picture, you have your baby in the car seat behind you and things are going down. You're going to have to get squirrely. You throw that blanket over the car seat so it covers it completely. That way you don't have to worry about any like incoming rounds or shrapnel, and you gun it and you're just like, goof, 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 make way.
I mean,
got to go home.
Hey, the world's a scary place, and you know, you don't have to hurt anyone to be able to protect yourself with armor. I mean,
passive.
I hate to use the word pacifist because I don't like that terminology and the negative connotations that it has with it when it comes to, you know, people's holistic approach of self-defense and manhood and things like that. So the word pacifist has this negative connotation to it, and I don't like that negative part of it. I don't like that idea. But in this particular situation, we have to use the pacifist way. Like, it's the most passive way to protect yourself. So you don't have to own a gun. You don't have to like guns, but having armor, someone with a gun can't hurt you. So you can obviously defend yourself, where, you know, the gun situation might be more of the offensive role to, you know, do damage if you need to. And then the armor is more of a defensive role. Hey, I may not even be carrying a gun, but I've got some armor nearby, or I'm wearing armor. And there's a little bit, you know, also medical personnel, like when you're out on the battlefield, I mean, your medics wear armor. They sometimes aren't carrying a gun. They're dealing with a patient. They're dealing with a hurt soldier on the battlefield, but they still need armor to protect themselves. It doesn't mean the enemy is not going to try to, you know, kill you just the same. So, you know, people treat armor as this situation where it's got this negative context to it, but it really shouldn't, because anyone can just have a set of armor. There's nothing wrong with protecting yourself.
That's right. And I mean, if you look at it from a medical aspect or a public service aspect, whether it's firefighters, because sometimes firefighters are put into situations where they have to go in and put themselves in dangerous situations. I mean, I think the Safe Life Defense armor, that's really what it caters to. It's really like so the plate that we have here, this is a Safe Life Defense in conjunction with plate. So this is not a standalone plate. It will not stop anything without the FRAS armor system that you have. And I think it's a really cool option. I mean, as far as what it does, it's a flexible armor system, and you can, and that might not provide that level 4 protection with that plate in conjunction with the FRAS system will give you that level 4 protection. But again, that is sold separately. It does not come with the original FRAS, and then you add that for added protection. And it's light. It's not heavy at all. I mean, it's...
Well, what's nice about this type of a setup, too, is that it allows you to tailor the armor for your specific needs. So if you want something flexible and form-fitting, but still will protect you from a whole bunch of scary threats. I mean, we've tested the FRAS. It's some pretty gnarly stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it will stop some substantial threats, okay? But if you're not worried about having that extra you know, protection against the absolute worst threats, well, then guess what? You can drop this plate out and still have really good protection and flexibility. So, you know, the FRAS system is good if you want to have the flexibility of tailoring the armor to your exact needs and removing what you don't want. And if you know you're going to go into a really super scary situation, obviously you want to turtle up, and you can turtle up. Yep. So that's nice.
What I will say is that, you know, I'm seeing, as far as body armor goes, I'm seeing a disturbing trend of, I guess, people that are buying armor and using the price point to dictate. It's almost like a flex. It's like, oh, I have this armor. It's 2 pounds and it's buoyant. And it was literally, you can get that. They're $999 per plate. You run two plates, it's $2,000.
We've tested it before.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you ever saw the video we did a video where we took the Spartan armor. I forget the exact name for those types of plates. They've got a special name to them, but mm-hmm. they're really light, they're very buoyant, yep. and literally they float.
Yeah, the positive buoyancy. Yeah, I mean,
crazy.
It's great if you're like a maritime operator, and I don't know if it's actually going to keep you up. You still might have to work a little bit, but I mean, the fact that it floats is awesome. But, you know, it still has a finite lifespan on it. It's like spending $2,000. And the thing about those types of plates, and that's any plate, I would say there's plates that are $600 a piece that are, you know, 2 pounds non-buoyant. But you have to understand is the job that they do is the same whether the plate is $99 or $135 or $1,000. It's to save your life. And I don't want you to feel like you have to go and spend $1,000 to save your life. I mean, there's steel plates that do, and people, this is the worst. People like kind of rag on steel plates, but I'll tell you what, I would rather be alive and take that gripe from you than have it affect my judgment and not buy it and be dead.
I agree 110% completely with you on that. The thing about AR-500 armor, and I don't mean necessarily just the brand AR-500, mm-hmm. their armor is fantastic, by the way, but just the concept of it as an armor. I mean, AR means abrasion resistance.
Yep.
And the higher the number, the stronger it is. So like you got AR-550 plates, 500 plates, and things like that.
I think I've seen 600, haven't I?
I think so.
Like very, very like few, but I think I have seen it out there.
But when you get into those types of armor, now the metal armor, yeah, it's really, really heavy. It is definitely on the top end of the weight. It's more like an old sappy plate. Mm-hmm. But imagine a basic metal plate, but with like really good spalling mitigation and things. And then you dive into the idea of it being a very affordable price. I can see where that is a very attractive type of idea for people, because like this old flat, barely curved sappy plate here, you can take, you know, an AR-500 plate and have a bit of a curve to it, mm-hmm. and a little bit better mitigation on the spalling and stuff. And for a very fair price, you've got a plate that can totally stop a lot of rounds and multi-hit. Now, of course, the spalling mitigation is going to begin to fail in that multi-hit type of scenario, because the spalling, you know, kind of will tear it up and stuff. But they can take a lot of abuse. So, yeah, they're heavy. Yeah, they're bulky. Yeah, they're not quite as a cool guy and high speed, but if you just need bare bones protection, they will certainly do the job.
They will. And you know, if they're inside of a carrier, the only person that's going to feel that weight is you. So, I mean, it's not like the guy next to you is going to go, oh, I can see your steel plates through your carrier. Like, you really can't. And I mean, the chances of you wearing that vest for an extended period of time for it to really be like detrimental to the impact of your mission is very low.
I mean, now when you start talking, you know, fast roping out of a helicopter, yeah. onto a giant mountaintop and spending 4 days doing, you know, crawl on your belly reconnaissance and sneaking around and, you know, huffing and puffing up and down a mountain left and right or something mm-hmm. like that, or going through some long trek in the jungle in some super hot, humid or arid environment or any extreme environment, yeah, over time, you know, those pounds start to matter. So if, you know, you're high-speed Delta operator, then sure, you want to go for the high-speed gear and the good lightweight plate and the buoyancy. You know, maybe your mission deals with water threats or being near water. You obviously don't want to have a situation that if you get a little tired, you're going to sink through the water or anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, operator fatigue is certainly a thing. For your occasional, you know, I guess, weekend warrior type that's just going to go do some training, or maybe you're just in a home defense situation, you want to have some armor you can put on. The heavier weight is probably something you can overlook, because it's not like you're wearing it 9 hours a day.
That's right.
Doing missions or fulfilling the task that you have to do in your job. And then, of course, your operators and stuff. Yeah, if you're wearing armor 10 hours a day, those pounds are going to start to matter.
And that's kind of where a lot of people that are buying armor, this is one industry that is cost prohibitive to get the, quote, the best gear, because the best gear is like literally outside the realm of actually purchasing it. So if you got like the same like gear that tier one operators that you envy so much, you're out like 10 grand. The night vision alone is probably like at minimum 20 grand, 30 grand.
Yeah. And it's like, what's your life worth to you?
Yeah.
And then what is the chance that you think you're going to get into a situation, right? If I'm buying, you know, $100 set of armor, $100 per plate armor, that's not super expensive, but still good quality. Do I think that I'm going to get in a shootout every single day? No. You think, all right, when I need it, I need it. I'm going to put it on when I need it. And hopefully it's going to, you know, if the guy ends up shooting where my armor is, I know it's going to protect me. Like, the chance that you're going to have to use it is so low that, yeah, you don't have to max out on spending a bunch of crazy money on some armor that theoretically, more than likely, and hopefully, and what you're planning, you probably will never use. Versus a guy that's an operator in a military environment, he might be getting shot at every other day. So for him, yeah, if there's some way that I can get some side plate protection, maybe I can get some throat protection, you know, maybe there's a groin protector I can put on, you know, depending on the situation and the armor technology. Yeah, if you've got some super lightweight armor, you might could have all of that extra protection for still even coming under on the weight of what a traditional standard sappy plate would end up weighing.
You're right. And you know what I really appreciate now that I think about it? I didn't think about this until you mentioned attaching all the stuff to it. I really appreciate those vests that they gave us, because everybody wanted to attach all of your gear straight to your vest. So you had like the MOLLE integrated carrier. So everybody started like putting all the stuff directly onto the vest. And it made sense until I remembered that we were mechanized and we had to fit through turrets and hatches, and that you can't fit in the cupola that well with all this stuff strapped to you. So as gunners, we would just take the vests off and all of our MOLLE gear was attached to this vest, and we would kind of stow it. So we just ran slick carriers while we were in the cupolas. And then if we ever needed to have like dismount, I don't know why we would ever dismount other than the fact of getting hit with like an IED or something, but it was just really convenient to have that. So that's what that reminded me of. Sorry, I went off topic, but
no,
I was
that's
like,
fine.
I was
yeah, like, they man. Gave us those tan web gear.
Yeah, yeah.
Like just kind of crude web gear, but just had the MOLLE attachments. It was like basically a MOLLE vest.
Yeah, and you wore it over your
yeah,
like,
and
your
what I would do is I would actually attach all of the magazines and everything. I would get extra pouches and get extra ammo, mm-hmm. and I drape that over the back of the cupola. If we ever had to dismount, I'd just grab it and throw it on. Click, there you go. Now you got your mags on you.
Yep.
But when you're in the cupola, like you said, navigating within the confines of a tight space in a Humvee or Bradley or wherever you might be, yeah, you don't have to have it on your person. So that's one way that armor has improved, is the modularity of outfitting it for different situations.
Yep.
There's armor now that, you know, are set up for medics, where they've got medic pouches and all that type of stuff. Paramedics, you know, combat medics in warfare.
Jumpable plate carriers.
I know you've seen press armor. It says press on it. Like even reporters have armor.
Yep. So if we're looking at armor, so far we've only covered hard armor. So rifle plates. There's a whole other subset of armor for like soft body armor. So level 3, level 3A. And those are for handgun threats. So what we talked about is for rifle threats. Just because with the way that everything is right now, it's more likely than not to encounter a rifle in like, I guess, some type of public unrest or something like that. You're going to encounter a rifle. Like handguns, yes, but rifles, there's enough of them out there to where I would only probably feel comfortable going out with a hard armor or a rifle plate. The soft armor was initially rated up to a 44 mag, and that's like a level 3A. the thing I don't like about soft armor is that it doesn't actually like stop it from penetrating into your body. So it's like getting stabbed with the spoon, because it's like the spoon isn't sharp enough to break through the skin, but it is powerful enough to like go into your body. So it's like you're getting penetrated and then out, but it's just a deep, deep bruise. And it's, that would hurt.
You certainly can get some bloody whelps on you, even with the, you know, the soft armor, even though it's stopping the projectile, which believe me, you know, taking a 44 mag point blank to the chest, you're not walking away from that. I mean, that's not a very high likelihood that one can survive a gunshot like that. So getting a really bad bruise and having your breath knocked out and maybe staying in the fight long enough to save your life certainly outweighs the negative connotations there. The nice thing about modern soft armor too, and the reason that there is still a need for manufacturers to make soft armor. So people would probably ask like, well, if there's this awesome armor and it's very light in the upper end categories, why would I even bother having soft armor? The reason is a lot of people in their everyday lives wear armor under their clothing. Mm-hmm. Some personal security details might wear really nice fitted suits and things. They can still have some armor protection underneath their suit that's form fitting, and it's almost like wearing a shirt. In fact, speaking of suits, there are actually business suits that are made that are bulletproof. Now, granted, it's going to hurt, but that projectile will not pierce your body. And it's crazy to think that it can keep you in the fight and help your survivability. You're talking ballistic suits. Like, I'm talking a coat and suit and tie, like you see the Secret Service wearing a suit. They have suits that are bulletproof.
Could you imagine how heavy that would be?
They're heavy. Man. They are heavy. But, you know, you got the soft armor that you can wear up underneath your clothes and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And then obviously law enforcement, you see cops on the everyday beat.
Yeah, they're wearing
they've got to be able to wear their soft armor and wear their uniform. Mm-hmm. So there is still a need for soft armor depending on the application, what you're trying to accomplish.
And that's where these in conjunction with plates come in, because I believe they also do like a regular soft armor as well, that it kind of goes with outside of the FRAS system. But police officers all the time will carry, they'll have their plate carriers in the back, and they'll have their soft armor on. And then if they encounter a rifle threat, they kind of run to the trunk, they throw on their plate carrier, and then they engage that threat.
I mean, I think that's, you know, smart. If even for civilians, I mean, when you look at the everyday civilian populace, I mean, I keep a set of body armor in my truck ready to go with my rifle mags on. I keep my rifle in my truck because you never know. If something happens, you got to be ready. And you're either going to be a liability and in the way, because you aren't prepared and you're just a statistic at that point. You can either be a dead statistic or an alive statistic. So if you're not armed and you're not in the fight, you better get away from it because you can't contribute. If you can't contribute, the only way that you're going to wind up in that situation is dead. So, you know, I would rather be a contributing factor to the situation than just a freaking statistic. So for me, yeah, I keep my rifle, I keep my medical gear, keep all my extra, you know, some food and water in a backpack. I keep my armor, my rifle mags, a handgun, signal device, flashlight, an extra knife or two. Yeah, I keep some spare blankets in my vehicle. You never know. Someone might be in shock. They might be hurt. Medical gear, super important. I want to talk about that real quick before we end today's podcast. You're probably going to have a higher chance of needing to administer medical aid to someone than you are, you know, causing some type of a wound or injury or using a gun in an offensive environment. So you might be the first person to show up in a situation after something has just happened. So yeah, you need to be medically prepared. Armor is a part of that. Medical preparedness and armor go together because you can't help someone else if you get shot, right? You want to protect yourself while you're helping someone. That armor is a great passive way to add another layer to your security in terms of how you're approaching the situation. So maybe not every person falls into that type of a scenario, but I like to keep armor and a firearm in my truck because you just never know when you might need to go assist in a situation or protect yourself from a very deadly set of circumstances.
It's true. It's almost like you looked in the back of my car because you've seen it. I have my armor there. I have my rifle stowed out of sight. Armor is sitting in sight, but it has full loadout on it, medical. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you have to keep that stuff on hand and more importantly, like use it, put it on. walk around. Like, I walk around my neighborhood. My neighbors might think I'm crazy, but it's okay because I don't care what they think. So walk around with your armor, get used to the weight. You know, it does take some getting used to. You're wearing a vest and it's going to constrict your breathing. Walk uphill, walk downhill, walk around the park. You might get some funny looks, but there's no difference between you walking around the park or walking around the neighborhood and a CrossFit guy running around with his vest on. The only difference mine is that I actually have magazines on mine, but that just adds to the weight. You know, it's good for you, but yeah, get out there and use it and get used to having it on and the constriction, because it's not easy. I'll tell you that right now.
You know, I know of some guys that will actually take their, and gals, don't want to leave our ladies out. Yes. Guys and gals.
Yes.
No matter who you might be. There are ladies and guys that will go and do their like CrossFit training and their exercise and their cardio while they're wearing their armor in the gym. And that way they get used to that extra weight. And when you take it off, you're even faster because you're used to like weighing yourself down. So it helps increase your speed. That's why you see guys running with parachutes and stuff, like these little mini parachutes, because it's adding that extra resistance. And when they take the parachute off, guess what? They're faster because they're training their body to move faster, to be faster. And it's expecting that resistance because that's what you've trained yourself to in your muscle memory and, you know, that lactic acid building up in your muscles and you're getting all sore and you're really working yourself out harder than what you can do without it. So same thing with armor. You could wear armor and use it as part of your workout routine.
You really should. If anything, just to get used to the way that the load balances. I mean, when you're walking around with it, I mean, even at your lightest plate, let's just say you have 6-pound plates, which is average. I like your pretty average, like good quality plate, 6 on the front, 6 on the back. That's 12. You have full combat load of ammo, probably another 20 pounds in ammo and magazines. Then you have your carrier, your web gear. So you're, and if it's fitted properly, it's like sitting right on your shoulders and pulled up, cinched on your waist. It takes a lot of getting used to with like moving your knees, your ankles, going uphill. So I cannot reiterate that enough, is that, you know, don't just have it sitting in your closet, because chances are you won't be able to put it on in time in case you actually need it.
Yeah. And, you know, that's important to go through and make sure your stuff is set up. So I think this is a really great video and or podcast, depending on where you're tuning in. We really want to take a moment to thank everybody who tuned in. We are getting towards the end of our show here. I think this was a really nice roundup on some of the armor technologies. I think we dove into quite a few weeds here and, you know, posed some philosophical questions and some historical questions that we can, you know, maybe merit some deeper research and, you know, maybe shed a little bit of light on where the armor might be going moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, technology is only getting better, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see how these two keep hitting this head-to-head matchup.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to win.
That's right. That's right. And there's always, I think the fine line's always kind of in the middle there as to where people are going to wind up. So thanks for tuning in. We really appreciate all of our listeners and or viewers. You know, if you're tuning in here on YouTube, thanks for watching. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you're listening on the podcast, be sure to leave us a great review, and that'll help us show up in the search results a lot better. We post every Friday here on Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. Have a great week. Live free, be happy, and we will see you next Friday. Bye, everybody. Woo! Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Inc. by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.